Good evening, and welcome to today's program of the Commonwealth Club of California, brought to you from our offices overlooking San Francisco's Financial District. I'm Suzanne Guyette, Director of Marketing and Public Relations for the Club, and your chair for today. We also welcome the listeners of WUSF 90.1 FM in Tampa, Florida, one of more than 200 radio stations across the nation carrying America's longest-running radio program. And now it's my pleasure to introduce today's guests. Pat Coletto's restaurant designs have been dazzling diners for more than 25 years. He has worked his special magic on more than 150 restaurants in cities across the country and around the world. From Post Rio in San Francisco to Chop's Steakhouse in Atlanta to the Silver Bullet Diner in Tokyo. Last month, Bon Appetit magazine named Pat Coletto Restaurant Designer of the Year. Recently, Pat has moved from designing restaurants to owning and operating them himself, in collaboration with several acclaimed chefs. In these collaborations, he's designed and built restaurants for each of these chefs that have allowed them to do the kind of food they've always wanted to do in an atmosphere inspired by their individual styles. An example is San Francisco's Farallon, which looks like an under-the-sea fantasy world, complete with pastel jellyfish lights and a caviar staircase to complement the sophisticated seafood prepared by Farallon chef Mark Franz. Pat Coletto appears tonight in conversation with Bill Sitara, food and wine critic for the San Francisco Examiner. Bill has written about food and wine in the San Francisco Bay Area for almost 15 years and has been at the Examiner since 1997. He was also the host of Restaurant Talk on KGO Radio and Let's Eat with Bill Sitara on KPIX. Please join me in welcoming Bill Sitara and Pat Coletto.
Thank you, Suzanne, and thank you all very much for coming tonight. Thank you for having me here. Before we start, I do want to tell one Pat Coletto story, like how we met. Actually, when I first started in this business about 15 years ago, I was working for another newspaper as a freelancer, and my very first assignment before I reviewed a restaurant or a glass of wine or anything was to review a book written by a fairly well-known architect in this town who not only fancied himself a great restaurant designer, but a great food critic, too. And he had written a book reviewing both the design and the food at various San Francisco restaurants. Well, I wanted some expert opinion on this, and having just eaten at Fog City Diner and thought that it was just probably the most perfect restaurant design I'd ever seen in my life and was just stunned by how gorgeous it was, I figured I should call this guy Pat Coletto. And so I got his name and his number, called him up, and we talked for quite a while. I got all the information I needed and decided not only was he a pretty smart guy and a pretty articulate guy, but he was also a pretty nice guy, and I kind of liked him. And so we stayed in touch and developed the kind of phone relationship that you do when you work in this business. So you know people intimately on the phone, but you've never, ever seen what they look like. And after a couple of years of this, we finally decided, you know, we should see what the other looks like, and made an appointment one day to go over to his office in Sausalito, where we were going to taste some olive oil, because Pat had just started to produce his own olive oil. And, of course, with the usual enthusiasm that he brings to everything, it was going to be the best damn olive oil on the planet. And so I go in his office, and on his desk are about 10 little cups of five different kinds, little paper cups like you get at the water fountain of different olive oils. And we chatted for a while. And figured, well, we got some stuff to do. We better get down to tasting this olive oil. And we looked around, and we didn't have any bread. And where Pat's office was, there really wasn't any convenient place to get any bread, and so we couldn't get any bread. And so we decided, well, what the hell? We'll just sip it out of these little cups. Now, let me tell you, this is good olive oil. I mean, this is really good olive oil. I've had this olive oil plenty of times since, and it's great olive oil, but sipping olive oil out of a cup, the first word that comes to mind is vile.
Oh, Bill.
But we soldiered on and finally decided that, you know, maybe what we should do is just try this again some other time when we had some bread. And, you know, this is not any kind of great foodie epiphany story or anything, but it's very close to my heart because, you know, that's the kind of guy that Pat is, you know, that no matter how much success he has, no matter how many great restaurants he opens, no matter how many accolades and great reviews he gets, he's always the kind of guy that you can sit down and chug a glass of olive oil with. Anyway, over the years, I've been very, very lucky to be able to follow Pat's career and to write about it. I'm very proud to know him as a restaurant designer, and I'm even more proud to know him as a friend.
Thank you, Bill. I appreciate that. I have to tell you, Bill took that so in stride. I never planned on bringing any bread. I was so used to just drinking olive oil, you know? I mean, just smell it. And the way you really drink olive oil or taste it is you take a little bit and you put it on the back of your hand and you get it kind of warm and you smell it to get the nose and everything. And then you look at it kind of and then you just take a little sip of it and drink it. And Bill was so amazed that we were going to, like, drink olive oil out of cups. It absolutely just blew his mind. But you went on. Remember those olive oil cruets that you gave me about five or six years ago? You've still not been to our house to still see those. We've been trying to get Bill up to our new place up in Napa for I don't know how long, but it has the same olive oil that when you gave it to me 5 years ago. So when you come up, we better
change it. Can I have a glass of it when I get there?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
We'll swig a little olive oil, Bill. No problemo.
You know, I do want to go into the kind of chronological thing, but I would like to break out of the chronology just for a moment because, you know, I alluded to Fog City Diner earlier, and not only was that a moment for me seeing that restaurant, but I really believe that it helped define what the new American, not faux European, but the new American restaurant was going to look like and has looked like ever since. And I was wondering, Pat, if you would tell the story of, one, how you came to do that restaurant, and two, the precise moment when you knew it was going to be a success.
It was pretty funny. One time, in the late 70s, I had the unlucky experience of being in exactly in the wrong place at the wrong time. And I did a restaurant up in a place that sticks in my throat. It's called Ukiah. Ukiah. Now, I love Ukiah, and I love all the people in Ukiah. And I used to tell people, oh, I'm doing a restaurant up in Mendocino County. Anyway, this was a place that I got involved in and was one of the first places that I ever had any equity in or any ownership in. And I got it for designing and building this whole hotel and restaurant. I got to keep a third of this whole deal. Well, I poured my heart into this place for a couple of years. And kind of a sad story, Bill, is that I was really involved and we were full-blown under construction and we were restoring this 100-room hotel, and it was every room was different. It was before all the bed and breakfasts and before all these quaint, you know, country inns and all this stuff. And I knew it was Mendocino, and Marin County was growing, you know, Mill Valley was popping, and, you know, Sausalito, and everything was just growing, and this was just the next natural place to go. And one morning I was driving into work, and I looked at the road sign, and it said population 46, you know, elevation 12,411. No, I thought it was just the opposite. And I turned around and I went all the way back, and it was like there was only, like, there was nobody that lived up there. And at that point, I realized I really had made a big mistake, and I had not listened to myself. So anyway, I found myself up in Mendocino and in Ukiah, and a couple of guys walked in one day, and they were fascinated. This place really was a beautiful spot. It was all handmade, brought back all the great craftsmen of the day, and we hand wove all the fabrics, and we made all the light fixtures, and We just did everything. It was a 100-year-old property, and it really was gorgeous. But later, a good friend of mine who was interested at the time of buying it, he finally came to me and he said, "Pat, I don't know how to tell you, but," he says, "the Palace Hotel is really kind of like, how can I say, it's a kind of a diamond set in an asshole." And that sums it up, and that was one of the worst experiences of my whole life. But there was a couple of guys that really, really loved this place, and they were Bill Upson and Bill Higgins. And at the time, they had only owned a little restaurant called Mustard's. And I gave them a tour of this whole place, and they loved it and everything. And time went by, and I finally was having lunch down in Mustard's a year or two later. And I tried to get in the restaurant, and I couldn't get in, and they were booked up. And then somebody grabbed me out in the parking lot and said, "No, come on in. You can come on in and do it. And are you that guy that did that restaurant, that hotel up there?" And I went, "Yeah." And they said, would you please design a restaurant for us? We have this place in San Francisco." And so they took me down and showed me the Fog City location. And I don't know how many of you remember Fog City Diner before. It was three failed restaurants. It was a horrible little garage bungalow kind of sitting around. It was an army, building. It was completely fallen apart. There were three or four buried cities below it. It was just... it was a piece of garbage. And I went, sure, why not? I always wanted to do something in San Francisco. At the time, I designed over 109 restaurants. So Fog City was the 110th restaurant that I ended up doing in San Francisco. And I said, "Well, what do you want? What do you want to do there?" And they said, "We want a diner, and we want to have American food, and we want it to kind of to be, sexy on the outside and warm on the inside." Okay.
And?
Is that it? So anyway, they turned me loose, and I took off fantasizing about what that place should be. And to me, every restaurant should have some kind of a story. All the great restaurants in the world, all the places that I love in Paris and the old ones in San Francisco, the classics, the really classic restaurants, all have a story. They all seem to grow there. All the great places in Venice and in Rome and all these places, somebody didn't design them. They kind of evolved. They kind of grew there. So I began to put a fantasy together for this garage down there that's now Fog City Diner. And my fantasy was that, first, the little part in the front was, that you drive past was a little old railroad car that was there, a classic diner story. And, they used to cook hamburgers there and do that. And then this guy ran it for a long time, and then his son had an idea to kind of expand it. So a ferry boat had washed up on the beach, or in the fantasy anyway. And so he took all the parts of the ferry boat out, and that was all the parts in the center and everything. And he put the parts together. So the middle part was a ferry boat. And then he had a kid, and then he was kind of this wild kid back in the 80s. So he added on what is the bar, which was kind of sharp and fancy and flashy and everything in the back. And I just kind of crunched this whole thing all together, and it seemed kind of like a crazy enough idea. We started building this thing and putting all the stainless steel on it, and it was made all the light fixtures and did all the stuff. And people used to come by every day and look and just laugh at us, and they would go, "What a crummy location. I can't believe that you're putting a restaurant here in this location. This is awful, So anyway, I'll shorten the story. I know the guy with the little clock's going to come over here in a second. And opening night, and I showed up, and there was all the lights. And I mean, everybody, you think of Fog City now as a fixture, but I mean, when you really think back into 84 or something like that, it was a long time ago. And I stepped outside, it was just a jam-packed thing, and people were just incredibly excited and having an unbelievable time. And the thing really, my fantasy was working and really happening. And I remember I spent a lot of time making those front windows drop down, so you can actually take these things and they drop down, but they weigh about 500 pounds. So it always the waiters would have to make the people get out of the seats, move over, and then they'd lower the booth. So we had them all lowered that night and everything. And I was standing outside just looking at this whole thing, walking around, and this guy kind of said, "Psst, hey, come here, come here." I said, "What are you looking at this place for?" I said, "Well, I designed this place." And he said, "Really? You're kidding." He said, "I got to tell you something, Pat." He said, "My name's Herb Cain." And he said, "This place works." And I went, "Yeah, all right." That was great. Yeah. That's the story of Box City Diner.
Yeah, and it's just kind of taken off from there. You know, Pat, if you would, give us the brief thumbnail bio, how you got into this business. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but you're not a school-trained architect or anything. Just real world trained. How'd you get into the business and start there?
It shouldn't be a thumbnail sketch. It should be a fingernail sketch. See, I got these two fingers are chopped off. I've got a 3.5-year-old son who's always looking to, "Papa, what you do is those fingernails?" And he's always, I catch him looking at me and looking at these things and doesn't know what to do. But that's how a German bartender orders 4 beers. Svibia. 5 beers. No, 5 beers. That's why I drive. Anyway, I was a carpenter for a long time. I used to live up at Lake Tahoe. And I got out of school. I didn't want to go to college, so I took off traveling. Drove a Model A Ford down to South America when I was 17. And I was a $500 bet, so I came back, drove across Canada, end up in Lake Tahoe, absolutely penniless, had no money, and got a job up there putting a shake roof on a little real estate office, a little teeny garage. And so I ended up just staying there. So I was a carpenter in the summertime, and I started waiting tables at 19 in the wintertime because I was a big guy. You know, I weighed about 230 pounds. I looked about the same as me except with hair. And it was very easy for me to get a job, and I got a job up at the River Ranch up in Tahoe. And, you know, it was really kind of easy. It was when I finally grew up, I just started building restaurants. It was as simple as that. There was nothing happened. I mean, this was back in the days you didn't have to have any real training or any real education or do anything. And the guy that was building the first refectory steakhouse, his wife, I used to drink in the bar that she was a bartender, the Hearthstone up at Lake Tahoe, and said, "Well, we're building a restaurant down in Marin. You know, maybe you could get a job down there." So I got a job for $3.50 an hour being a carpenter at the refectory steakhouse. Is that my stomach?
No, it's mine, actually, Pat. Sorry.
Funny sound outside there to do it.
I got to lay off those burritos.
So that was it. I just literally started, building a restaurant. And the story was is that this guy had to go to leave for 10 days. And I got really inspired. I kind of got the picture of what this place was, and I was just a glorified carpenter. And I said, "Well, why don't I just stay up around the clock for a week or 10 days, and I had this one buddy of mine, and we just stayed up, and we just kept building and building and building and building, and I changed a bunch of things, and shit, I was only getting $3.50 an hour anyway. I figured, what am I going to lose, $100 or something? It's big money. So anyway, he came home, and we had finished the entire restaurant. The whole thing was done, and it was like, he couldn't believe it, So he made me a project manager and construction foreman, and I got a raise to $5 an hour. And that's how it all started. I built 20 refectory steakhouses back then.
And if I'm not mistaken, kind of the beginnings of the modern American restaurant, the real seed, if you will, was kind of launched in the refectory, and I don't know if anyone remembers Victoria Station. Tell us how that came about. What we consider now the modern American restaurant grew out of those beginnings. That Victoria Station refectory, the wood fired grill, that kind of thing.
When I really think back at what truly started the whole foodie movement and where we are in America today, food-wise. It's pretty pretty silly, really, because I was right in the middle of this whole thing back as a teenager, and it was all right when the refectory was happening. It was just a little explosion that was going on in that time, and where all of restaurant and everything that we experience today, tonight, and the great restaurants that are in all around San Francisco and New York all happened in a 55-gallon drum on a back street in Honolulu. That's a true story. This was the thing that was before the Refectory Steakhouse was Buzz's and Chuck's Steakhouse and then the Refectory, and they all happened like it was only like in a year. And in Hawaii in those days, you could not get anything good to eat if your life depended on it. There was nothing. You could get plate lunches and frozen food and frozen vegetables and frozen nothing. There was nothing. So this guy had an idea. Oh, look, why don't we just buy some great Top Hat corn-fed Chicago beef. We'll fly it in. We'll cut it up. And, we'll take a 55-gallon drum, cut it in half, put a bunch of charcoal in it, kiawi wood up there. We'll put it on the sidewalk, and we'll just start barbecuing these things just with salt and pepper and maybe a little bit of garlic, and we'll put it on there, and people walk down the street, and we'll just be cooking it up, and they'll want it. And sure enough, they did it. You know, they put it on the street. Of course, there was no health department in those days. You'd get away with anything. I mean, this is, what, 35 years ago or something. And they started doing it, and people would line up down the street with paper plates and little paper knives and forks and all this stuff. And then they goes, well, this is incredible. This is fantastic. Do you have any salad? And they went, no, I had this other half of the 55-gallon drum. So they took that half of the 55-gallon drum, they put a bunch of ice in it, and then they just went over to the grocery store, and they got a bunch of lettuce and tomatoes and stuff, and they stuck it in there. And people would go, oh, this is great. And they have another plate, and they kind of put the stuff on and some wishbone dressing or something on top. And I swear that's how it started. And the idea was to have high-quality food in a fun, no-frills atmosphere at a really reasonable price. And that started the whole thing. It was so popular. Where they parked their little 55-gallon drum, behind it was a little house for rent. And so they rented the front part of this house, and they kind of set it up on the front porch. And so people kind of sat around inside the house and put little tables. And in a matter of like 2 months, that's really where the whole thing happened. And it just caught on. And steakhouses really began, were the seed and the whole thing that began inspiring what we experience today. And I could go on for more, you know, explaining that whole thing. But that's really where it happened.
Now, you talk about fun, good food, great atmosphere, that kind of thing. Segue time. Your philosophy of doing a restaurant, when you see an empty space, what do you see, what do you want the customer to get out of it when you've designed that space? What governs your...
My insanity.
That too.
The lunacy going back. I'm gonna insert one other little part into this whole thing, because that's a big jump from a 55-gallon drum to Farallon or Boulevard or Post Trio or, you know, any of those places. Another thing happened, and it happened in Sausalito, and it was back in the early days when San Francisco was doing a lot of drugs at large, and there was a lot of hallucinogenic things going on, and it was a time of growth and a time of fantasy and a time of rebirth of craftsmanship and a rebirth of just an awareness of all the great things that were out there that had just been kind of smothered over for, I don't know how many years, 50 years or something like that. And there was a restaurant on the waterfront in Sausalito that sprung up. And it was a restaurant that was called The Trident. Do you guys remember that one? I happened to have a little apartment across the street from the Trident, and there were a whole bunch of hippies before their hair had even had time to grow out in those days. That Frank Werber, who was the general manager of the Kingston Trio, gave these guys all jobs, and they all just got and locked themselves in this place, did a lot of acid, smoked pot. You know, there was a lot of pretty ladies around all the time. This was the time of free love, and, you know, bare-breasted women were really a great... That was, everything was cool, and everything was just, you know, normal.
Do I sense a little nostalgia here, Pat?
Yeah, this is, oh, God, I really try to think back on all this, and I couldn't believe it. But so they started building this restaurant, and it was before restaurants all were like dark, smelly places that smelt like spilled Manhattans and cigarette butts and there was a few good restaurants, but we're going back. I'm really dating myself now, but restaurants were dark places, and there was not a lot of reality in it. There was no concept of food. There was absolutely no idea of really good food. Maybe a few French restaurants, you know, you could you go in a very pretentious place, kind of, I think I will have the Chateaubriand, you had no idea what any of this stuff was, but the Trident, they brought in life, light, curves, wood, craftsmanship, candles, you know, incredible people, and they brought in health food. This was back when it was just gratuitous kind of health food. It was healthy. It was fresh. The idea wasn't... You know, it wasn't covered with chemicals or grown with chemicals or whatever, but it was healthy. But most of it tasted pretty horrible. You know, it was raspberries and lentils poured on top of it. You know, and it looked really beautiful and everything, but you just ate it because it was healthy. So, okay, you have the 55-gallon drum over on this side. And then about just a couple of years passed because the steakhouse thing evolved a little bit. And so they started actually having tables and chairs and hatch covers and started cooking decent. And steaks were a good deal then. They were actually, you know, health food back in those days. You know, it was healthy, good, fatty meat. You know, it was wonderful, you know, to eat in salads. You get to eat all kinds of great salads and do it. Then the Trident really, from my viewpoint, started the whole entire movement of architecture and movement of creativity. So restaurants started to say, hey, let's get out of the dark ages in this horrible place. Let's go to some place that's fun. Let's just start doing things that are, you know, take people out of their environment, out of their reality, and let's go do something fun. I got it. You know, we'll put waiters in Bermuda shorts and Hawaiian shirts and... And we can write the little, you know, the menus on Lancer bottles and doing this stuff. Or I got it. We can do it in a boxcar, right? Let's just cook a bunch of food and put it in a boxcar. Or I got it. Let's do it in a sawmill. That would really be cool, you know. We have big tables, and we could just put them in the sawmills. It could be saws all over and rusty stuff and everything.
If anybody complains, you just run them through the blade.
Yeah, we just run it through the blade. It's a little, yeah, extra thick cut, please. Yeah. Put it through the prime rib. Or we can put them in a cave. Caves are good. You know, caves are fun. We could do that. Or monasteries. We could put them in a monastery. The point was is that food became kind of a fun thing to do. In other words, it transported you out of your world. It gave you high quality food at pretty fair, reasonable prices based on high volume with friendly people. They started hiring college kids, you know, people that were going to school and this was their part-time job and you know, I always remember the little waitress ladies with the, I don't know where they get those flat shoes, you know, those little flat shoes, and then they polish them and they have the black aprons and all that stuff. That's all there used to be around in the old days. There were millions of them. And so they started creating a fun, transportive environment where you could get good food at a reasonable price in a really fun environment. And the key to it is that you had to really do a lot of volume in order to make that work because you couldn't make the huge margins of profit. So you make a little bit of profit, but you just do a lot of volume. And that's kind of, you know, where we evolved today.
And then, now, when you do a restaurante, you talk about the transportive environment, about taking people out of themselves, out of their everyday lives. How do you do that in brick and glass and wood? And when what guides you in creating a restaurant?
Well, I still really believe in all those funny things I just talked about, except something changed over the last 10 years is that everybody, all of you, all of us, everybody that dines began to become very sophisticated. I mean, we really started to understand food and understand health and understand cuisine. San Francisco especially became a melting pot for cuisine around the world. International foods became very available. Good old Alice Waters and, you know, Jeremiah and Wolfie and all the guys, they started having food grown so we could get arugula, little baby arugulas and everything, which there was nothing available before. I mean, 10 years ago, you couldn't get any of this stuff. So we started really getting fantastic food and having it available to us, you know, all the time. So the point I'm trying to make is that all of this great stuff no longer made any sense in a sawmill. It really didn't work in any of these. These places were fun, but they really didn't make any sense. So I decided to start creating places that were appropriate. They were appropriate dining establishments, places that were truly fun and uplifting and a wonderful place to be, you know, to have dinner. They were appropriate environment to do it. And I just began doing that, and it goes every possible different way you can think of. What causes a great design? How do I bring it in? It's whatever is appropriate for that particular place. For instance, say Boulevard. That's a classic building, the Autofred building, 100 years old, sat there dilapidated for 20 years under the freeway. It was built by a French charcoal magnate, if you can believe there were any French charcoal magnates out there. And he just wanted to have a piece of Paris, you know, back over here in San Francisco. So when I had an opportunity to get a hold of that space, I was actually brought in as a consultant. And they said, do you think this could really work as a restaurant? And I walked around and I said, not only do I think it could really work, you know, I'd love to do this place. You know, this would be great. So the fantasy there was I had this big old French building that had already been there for almost 100 years. So my fantasy was to create what should have been inside this building and what could have been in it. So I did it into three architectures. The front was a little classic French bistro. That's where the cook line is, and everybody's all crunched in and long, skinny little tables and everything. The bar area was like, what if we put a restaurant under the Eiffel Tower or put it under one of the pilings of the Golden Gate Bridge? You know, we had all these dome vaulted ceilings and brick and stone and everything. And then up in the back, one of my favorite restaurants that I went to with my wife, Shannon, in Paris, a place called Chez l'Ami Louis. And all we had was a pound of foie gras and a bottle of Chateau de Kim for lunch one day for $1,000. Oh, God, I still have indigestion from this whole thing. But it kind of looked like the back of that room. It was all peely things and everything. So the fantasies just all fit together, and I kind of started creating a fantasy of what that should really look like. And created a, I guess the key is real fantasies. I like to create real fantasies for people to be in. And that's hard to describe, you know, because I'm often insulted when the word theme restaurant get used. And many times, you know, going, the creator of any theme restaurants. They're not theme restaurants. You know, these are not theme restaurants are stupid restaurants that don't have anything to do. I mean, you don't you know, eat cheeseburger in a diving submarine, you know, that's going down. You don't do this stuff on top of Harley Davidsons, and you don't do it while you're racing around in movie sets and all that kind of stuff. So that whole theme thing, Bill, is, you know, yeah, it's thematic, you know, but it may be like a romantic image of Casablanca or some wonderful place that fits in the human mentality or something.
You know, one thing, Pat, that I've noticed about all of your restaurants, and whether stylistically they are more in a contemporary idiom or in a more kind of soft wood, brass, that kind of idiom, is that they always seem to be about comfort. And even something like Postria, which is a very contemporary look, it's still a very comfortable restaurant. And this kind of ties into a question from the audience, too. There are so many of these hard-edge, minimalistic restaurants now that it's like eating in a Mondrian painting. How do you see the whole issue of warmth, comfort, nurturing in a restaurant, yet at the same time making a design and stylistic statement?
I understand exactly what you're saying. To me, I think that people, when they want to go out to dinner and they rack their brain at night trying to go, well, what kind of food do I want to have? What do I really want to have? I don't really think that's what's going on subliminally and subconsciously in everybody's mind. What I really think they're saying is, what kind of mood do I want to be in? How do I want to feel tonight? Where do I really want to go? And, of course, you know, food plays into it. Absolutely, you know, food is a major part of the whole program. But people want to go to places, in my mind, that transport them to a place that is, like, better or different or more uplifting than where they are every day. So they want to go to a place that makes them happy, that they like, that I call home place. That may not be their home place where they are at home all the time, but it like makes them feel it's a kind of place that attracts them. I call restaurant people traps. And, you know, I don't mean that in a negative way. Whenever I design a restaurant or create a restaurant, the very first thing that any intelligent restaurateur or restaurant designer does is he makes what's called the call. You have to make the call is, what are you trying to do here? You know, what am I trying to create and who am I trying to get here? So what you do is you picture exactly a stereotypical group of the people that you generally want to come to this restaurant. And then you try to create an environment that makes them happy, that psychologically, subliminally attracts them and draws them to this restaurant. And one of those key elements, Bill, is people like to be in places that are real and that are very, very comfortable and that just makes them feel like maybe a little bit better human being. I mean, one of the things I like to do in restaurants, and I've always done it for 30 years or something like that, is I use real stuff. I mean, I don't use plastic, and I don't use artificial things. I use real things, and I use things that are built by real people, by craftspeople, and by artists. And the concept is there is that if it's very real, and you can see it and touch it, that it's real, real. It's not Formica. Oh, sorry, that's Formica.
Never mind.
I'm sorry. It doesn't matter, really. Zenith, it's real. It has nothing to do with it. I'm just kidding. You believe then more in the food. And you have to go back. I've been talking evolutionarily here. I'm going back 20, 25 years, you know. You start believing in the environment is being real, that people care, that they make a statement. They're just not trying to do a quickie, you know, and throw a few paintings up on the walls and kind of get it done. They do it all for real, and it's, you know.
What about some specific design tricks that help? You mentioned the real materials. I remember one time you told me that, and again, this ties in with a question from the audience about noise, which I have several questions from the audience about
noise.
You almost got me there, Pat. Almost. But I remember one time you told me that you want a certain level of ambient noise in the restaurant because otherwise it sounds like you're eating in a morgue and it's not comfortable. But you want right where people are sitting not to be so noisy, so you pad the underside of the table to absorb some of any other specific design tricks like that with lighting, with noise, with the structure, the flow of the dining room, or anything that give people that sense of home, of comfort, like that?
Sure. Noise is not the word that we're looking for. What we don't want is noise. What we want is sound quality. It's impossible to put, but there's 200 people sitting in here. If we were all having a big party and a big dinner right here in this room, even though it's got acoustical tile and it's got a few drapes and things like that, it would absolutely be deafeningly loud. And there's a magic to creating a festive environment. People want to be in a place where there's a lot happening and there's things going on and there's like a party kind of going on. But it's the kind of party and it's the sound quality that you're really trying to achieve. They did a test one time, a long time ago, back in the 30s, where they recorded a bunch of geese eating out in a grain field. They just put speakers out in there and they recorded a whole bunch of geese. And then later they went back out in the field and there were these geese flying way high up and they played it up in the sky. And these geese just went storming down there. So we kind of like the same thing. If you go to a restaurant or something and you open the door and you look inside and there's, you know, three or four little tables over there and they're going tink, 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 tink. Look at it. Nervous. You just turn around and walk back out. It's like a bad sign. But at the same time, you don't want them to be into a mob scene and you don't want to have sound deafening you. So if you create a very popular restaurant and you're doing that from a lot of different things, I mean, you have to have a great looking place, you have to have really great food, you've got to have good service, you've got to have the whole thing, but you want to have people having a party. So the trick is to try to mitigate the deafening noise. So it's the sound quality that you're looking for. Farallon is one of the most difficult spaces in the world to try to deal with that because we do a very large volume of people and it's a natural sound chamber. You know, it's kind of like the Cistern Chapel, that big pool room. You can be whispering to somebody over on this side of the room and these people on this side of the room can hear you. And if you sit in the center, it focuses all the sound right to the center of the room. So I almost considered removing that mural, that incredible old hand-painted mosaic, because I knew it was just a disaster. But instead, I did every possible trick that I could think of to mitigate the sound. And what you do is you just try to stuff a room full of soft things, every possible place that you can. So you use fabric on the walls, you use drapes, you use upholstered seats, you use upholstered, comfortable chairs. You mentioned this must have stuck in your head, but we stick foam rubber underneath all the chairs and underneath all the tables so when sound is going and bouncing, you know, it bounces back into a soft surface. We try to coffer everything, create very small areas. So even though you have a large room, we try to break it up with architectural pieces. Every possible thing you can do, you must do to mitigate sound today. You know, people hate noisy restaurants, but they never go back to quiet ones.
Yeah.
So it's a sad story there.
You know, one thing I'm not sure that a lot of people know, and your reputation is so much as a designer, but so much of this conversation that we've had tonight has been about food. And about quality of food and freshness of food, and the restaurants that you own now or co-own with the various chefs are really about food. How does knowing as much as you do about cuisine, about food and wine, and that side of the restaurant influence what you do in terms of creating the restaurant?
Well, I think we go back to appropriateness. It's not creating a kitchen that works just the right way. I mean, sure, you have to know exactly the right kind of kitchen to put together. You have to know exactly the right equipment. You have to know exactly the right placement. You have to decide whether you're going to cook with live fire, or, you know, with gas or, you know, salamanders or whatever. Do you want to put food ruiners down from the plate warmers and all that kind of stuff to do it? But it's more creating a totally integrated concept, which is really only something. I think one reason that Fog City was so significant is that not all restaurants are now diners, but that was, I think, the first restaurant that we've been conscious of that didn't happen by accident, that was a completely integrated concept. In other words, the exterior design, the interior design, the lighting, the food, the service, the people, everybody that was involved, the pricing, the location, the whole idea was all integrated. So when you say, you know, how do you integrate the cuisine to the design, it means you have to integrate the entire idea, the entire concept, the whole thing into food.
Do you think you could do the same designs that you do if you didn't know as much about food as you do?
No, I don't think so. I think it's more knowing about eating than really about food. I mean, when you travel all around the world and all over the country and all you do is eat and drink, you know, you kind of pick up a little of this. You know, you absorb some of this stuff. So you osmose what is it right. You kind of intuit exactly what is right and how do you kind of put it together and make the whole thing really happen. So I definitely think that, yes, I have to know about cooking, and yes, I have to know about cuisine, and yes, I have to know how it happens, but I more have to know about how a particular style of food should be and what do people really want, you know, to have it be in order to create a place. We were just in Barcelona, and we went to a restaurant there called Los Caracoles. It's been there for a couple hundred years.
I've been there, actually. It's a great place.
That place is so fantastic. And out on the corner of this, it's a little teeny narrow alley that you walk down. It's only 5 feet wide, and you're bumping into people. And right on the corner of the restaurant outside is a live-fired barbecue with about 500 chickens cooking on this thing. And sparks popping all over the tourists and all these dirty guys, you know, with charcoal all over them. And they're walking through the restaurant with these big spits of things. And you go inside and it's a fascinating restaurant, you know, to be able to do it. So, you know, yeah, I now have to know how to rotisserie a chicken, but, you know.
You mentioned a restaurant like Los Caracoles, and question from the audience, you know, that's such a character-filled, just fabulously engaging kind of restaurant. How do you feel about the trend in a lot of restaurants lately to be this very minimalist, high-tech? Does that work for you, and do those restaurants have a future once kind of the novelty of them wears off?
Yeah, I really don't think so. I think that very sleek modern restaurants are driven largely by economics, and they're sold, they're marketed, and they're packaged that, hey, this is really cool and this is really the way it's going to be, I think that even with the very slick restaurants that are being created today, a lot of the ideas and concepts that people like myself and other designers and restaurateurs have been using now for the last 15, 20 years, they're still trying to pull off as much of that as they possibly can. They're still trying to get great lighting. They're trying to get great color. They're trying to get excitement. They're trying to get elevation. They're trying to break up the rooms, you know, in a very nice way without a lot of money, but they're not making a long-term statement. These restaurants will not stand up, in my opinion, long-term to the unbelievable test that is going to come over the next 5 or 10 years. I mean, the competition in the restaurant business, just like in every other business in America, is becoming so phenomenally huge that I can't sleep at night thinking about what you're going to have to keep up with. And that's why I often keep going back to the basics. But I really don't think that they get it, Bill, you know, long term. They get it short term. They may get their money back out. It does cost a lot of dough to go into the restaurant business. But you got to create a restaurant that's going to make it for 10 to 20 years. That's got to be your goal. You
know? And speaking of that and the economics of restaurants and everything, are we overbuilt with restaurants, with good quality high-end restaurants? Can all of them survive the inevitable economic downturn?
You know, San Francisco has always been overbuilt. It's as long as I know, as long as I can remember, San Francisco has always had too many good restaurants. And they've always been relative. There's always been really good restaurants, you know? So my feelings are that the good will continue to survive, and the rest of the restaurants will just kind of fade off the bottom. So to answer your question is, no, we can't all survive. They will not all survive. But the better restaurants, the top end of the restaurants, will survive, and the marginal restaurants will, unfortunately, you know, like you said earlier, you said you think they can, will they cannibalize each other or whatever? And that's not a really good way to say it, but, you know, it's true. I think the strong survive and the weak just won't happen.
Give me your take on this, if you will. It seems to me, looking at the restaurant scene in the Bay Area, that the middle, just like the middle class overall, is getting squeezed. On one hand, you have very well-financed, high-end restaurants that $2-4 million is not really that much money to get them open. And on the other hand, you have the
budget
small
job.
Family owned, the little place in the Mission, the little great little taqueria or Vietnamese place or whatever. But the places in the middle, the people who don't have millions, but yet they're not so small to be able to kind of fly under the radar, they're getting squeezed out. Do you see that, or is that just me?
No, I think that's absolutely true. It's corporate clones, people that are just going out and copying really good restaurants. So there's a lot of people in the business that really go out and say, well, I bet you if I put together 10 of the best ideas and just go all these restaurants and then I can just put them all together in this one thing, it's going to work. And then they fail and nobody understands. So the really good restaurants, the ones that come from the heart and the soul and are run by great food people and have good people with them and great people in the service side, you know, they will survive. What's been happening is there have been, in recent, just the last couple of years really, a giant resurgence towards ma and pa restaurants, and that's for a lot of reasons. A, the great chefs are spawning all kinds of new talent. There's a lot of new talent out there, and it's really hard to go out and start a big, brand-new restaurant. It's hard to find them. It's hard to finance them. It's hard to put them together. So they're putting together shoestring restaurants, but they have soul. They have character. They've got great food. You know, they've got good people, and they're operated by a family. You know, they're operated by – that's what you really, really want. That's what we want in the big, successful restaurants that we have. They're still driven by people, partners, you know, chefs, people that are doing it. The people that are just kind of in the middle and thinking, hey, this is a good location, or this is a good concept, you know, we can kind of crank this thing together and fit it in. It's just really not happening. I think there's a huge movement back towards old-fashioned restaurant, both at the high end and the middle end.
What do you look for in a chef that when you partner up with him or her to do a restaurant like Nancy at Boulevard or Mark at Farallon? What do you look for in a chef to go into a venture together with?
Really nice people. That's the main thing. You want them to be happy and easy to get along with. No, there's got to be a chemistry. there's really got to be something that works between us. And I look for people that are just at the right place in their career where they're ready. They're just ready. They've paid their dues as chefs. They've learned all the technical things that they can learn. They know quite a bit about the business. And they're kind of ready to make a move on their own. I mean, every chef in the world wants to have their own restaurant. I mean, just about every chef in the whole world wants to have his own restaurant or her own restaurant. So you got to kind of catch them exactly at the right time, and the chemistry has to work, and you have to have the right situation. I, unfortunately, have a lot of people that want to partner with me, and I'd love to do it, but you have to have the right thing happen. You just don't create a great restaurant. Say, I'm going to go out and look for this kind of deal, because it's really hard to find those kind of places where everything works and all the economics work and the whole package works, you know. So the right person at the right time in their career, at a right moment in history, and then it just somehow just kind of really just gels, you know.
You touched on this earlier, but can you give us kind of a look into your crystal wine glass?
It's a good idea, actually.
What the future holds from where the American food scene, where American restaurants are going to be going in the coming years?
I think that American restaurants, simply put, are just going to be better and better and better and better. We've figured it all out. I mean, look back 20 years ago, look at food today, and let's look at the little bit bigger picture. Let's just not look at restaurant. We think of restaurant, whenever you say restaurant to me, I think of, you know, relatively high-end dinner house. I'm talking restaurant at large, fast food restaurants, you know, McDonald's, you know, with all of the food that's out there today, they're going into fresher food. They're going into higher quality product. They understand that we can't, you know, serve junk anymore. The population is just way too intelligent now to do it. Mediocre restaurants, just plain run-of-the-mill, everyday, down-the-block restaurant. There's really good food out there. I mean, amazingly good food. I mean, we don't have fried foods, where there's a consciousness of fat. You know, the product is available across the board. All of the food suppliers in the Bay Area and across the country now, you can get really good, high-quality food. We're, of course, wiping out the oceans. I mean, you know, all the wild food and buffaloes and stuff, you know, they're gone a long time ago. But aquaculture is becoming very, very popular and very available and very high quality, sometimes more high quality than wild food and wild fish. So it's all available. I think the high end is going to continue to evolve. It's going to keep getting better and better and better. And I find that hard to believe, because I think food has gotten so fantastic and it is so good now. And there is a movement back just towards good home-cooked, natural, comfort Americana food, but I think it's just going to keep getting better and better as the wine keeps getting better and all the product keep getting better and the, you know, the fusion.
And we keep getting older.
We keep getting older. That's right. We're easier to please.
Pat, I think we've about reached the end of our time here, and I want to thank you very much for being here, and turn the program over to Suzanne.
Thank you very much.
Our thanks to...
Thank you.
Our thanks to restaurant designer Pat Coletto and Bill Sitara of the San Francisco Examiner, and our thanks to all of you for joining us. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the nation's oldest and largest public affairs forum, is adjourned.